Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to The Upgrade, a podcast from the team at lifehacker.com, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Andy Yorn, an editor at Lifehacker.
And April is Stress Awareness Month, so today we're talking about stress and anxiety with scientist Daniel Keating. Dan is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, where he focuses on developmental differences, whether they be cognitive, social, or emotional, in physical and mental health.
His new book is called Born Anxious: The Lifelong Impact of Early Life Adversity and How to Break the Cycle. We're very happy to have Daniel Keating with us today.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you. So in Born Anxious, you talk about a stress epidemic. What evidence is there for a stress epidemic in society today?
Well, there are three main lines of evidence that we have. One is that in a series of annual surveys that the American Psychological Association does, we've seen an increase in what people say about their levels of stress. The other thing we can look at is the rate of stress-related disorders and diseases. And the Center for Disease Control has been tracking this for quite a long time. And when we look at those things, and that includes things like metabolic disorders, obesity, diabetes, those sorts of things, sleep disorders that are associated with that, we see a very substantial increase over the last three decades or so. And then the final one is some very recent work that some researchers have done. You can, in fact, measure the sorts of things that chemicals that are in your body that you can measure as indicators of a kind of a stress load index on your body. And these are things that are associated with heart function, things that are associated with kidney function, things that are associated with liver function that are known to be indicators of something that will, if it continues long enough, likely result in some sort of disease. And over the last 40 years, we've been seeing a pretty sharp increase in that as well.
And the title of the book is obviously Born Anxious. So the thesis here is that some of these problems may actually start as early as when we're in the womb, right? So what's the main idea behind the book?
The starting point really for the story in the book is that excess stress that is experienced by the expectant mother or excess stress that's experienced in the kind of nurturing that happens in roughly the first year of life for a baby has the potential to make a change that we now understand a bit more about. It's called an epigenetic change. The specific kind of epigenetic change here is known as methylation. And the simple version of this is that a particular gene that's fairly central to how that stress system works, whose job it is to, in a sense, tell that stress response system to stand down, that things are cool, you can relax now, calm down, come back to a baseline, is hampered. And it's you can think of it as kind of like a faucet that won't quite turn off, but a faucet that's also highly reactive to getting flashback on pretty quickly. That means that for the same kinds of experiences that different individuals have, one who has one of these problematic stress systems, we call a stress dysregulated system, is much more likely to react, to turn that system on, and then to have difficulty coming back to baseline. That excess cortisol has two big things. One is that it affects how we behave, more likely to become reactive, quickly angry, flashpoint kinds of anger on the one hand, or to withdraw completely because we feel too threatened, the famous fight or flight response. In addition to the behavior, it is that excess cortisol through the system that has a lot of those negative effects on the body that we've identified in what we talked about before, like a stress load index or the CDC records of stress-related disorders.
So cortisol is the stress hormone, right?
That's right.
So we think about like the way that we are as a result of either our genetics, nature, or how we're raised, nurture. And you say that epigenetics is sort of this new science that points to a third factor. Can you explain a little bit about, like, how epigenetics works?
The simplest way to think about it is that epigenetics is a way that the genes can listen to the environment. The genes, in fact, are programmed to do a whole bunch of things that get carried out, things that are coded in our DNA that is unique to each of us. In addition, however, with the epigenetics, and particularly this relatively newer area of social epigenetics, how our social experiences affect this, the genes are, in a sense, listening to that environment. And in this case that we're talking about now, the specific pattern is that they're picking up on the fact that you're probably being born into, or have just been born into, a highly dangerous environment. That there is, if the mom is experiencing a very high level of stress, enough for the cortisol in her system to get through the placental barrier and raise the cortisol in the womb so that the fetus picks up on that, the genes of the fetus pick up on that information, or in the first year of life that there's dangerous things that are happening that are minimizing your nurturing, that those kinds of signals tell the genes, in a sense, that this is a very dangerous environment. And for survival purposes, your best bet is to stay alert, on edge, wired up, amped up, if you will, on a kind of a 24/7 basis, that you really should not relax. It's a very dangerous environment, and you should be prepared to react very quickly with fight or flight to anything that seems threatening. Now, in an environment where those threats are not huge, you wind up, of course, in a situation where that's driving you to do those sorts of things. If you're in a very dangerous environment, let's say a war zone, it may very well help to keep you alive, but it's still going to take a long-term toll on your body if you do survive.
So in terms of, like, normal, you know, day-to-day life, what kind of social stresses would actually have these kind of effects? And I mean, like, in a first world country, not necessarily like a war zone or anything.
A big source of stress, particularly in the U.S., which is suffering this kind of stress epidemic more than other places, there's a big issue around the notion of inequality that is stressing us out. So that if you're at a low end of economic difficulty, you have stresses that certainly feel like survival stresses, things like food insecurity, homing insecurity, homelessness potentially, a whole host of things that we can readily understand would very much raise the stress level of an expectant mom of whether or not she's going to be able to take care of the baby that she's about to have or the other kids that she already has, or the father for that matter as well in terms of being able to do that. So whatever parents are involved. And then you might say, oh, well, then it's a poverty problem. But in fact, it isn't. So if we look, if we go up the scale from, say, you know, lower SES to middle SES to upper middle SES and beyond, we see evidence of this at a somewhat decreasing rate, but we see evidence of this throughout. Why might, say, a middle-class individual have those sorts of feelings? Well, even if you feel like you're adequately provisioned with, you know, income and whatnot at the moment, when you have a high inequality society, the risks that you're going to slide down that scale if something goes wrong, like the 2008 financial crisis as a good recent example, if you fear that you're going to slide down or that you're not going to be able to see your kids maintain that level or even be socially mobile in a more positive direction, then that creates a major feelings of stress and sources of stress. Now, there are other reasons, of course, why nurturing might not be, other than those particular kinds of stresses, that might be active in a situation. So that if there are life events that create major stress, divorces, unemployment, and other sorts of things at any level of society, those things can create the level of stress we're talking about.
So can we just sort of define terms? You're a scientist. We use the terms that you're referring to colloquially, like stress, anxiety, panic, worry. What are the differences between these things in sort of what you're talking about?
Right. So stress is a perfectly good scientific term. We can use that. Stress basically means, on the one hand, it's the kind of things that we think of as stressors. That is the things that create stress for us. And I should add that stress dysregulated people may perceive more stressors than are actually in the environment. That is, it's your perception of stress, not the necessarily actual stress that you're under that can create the issues. the stress that we're talking about here is the stress response system. Now, I'm focusing on cortisol because we've got a lot of other data from other fields like epidemiology that tell us what are the consequences of having excess cortisol and carrying it around for a lifetime. The stress response system is more complicated than that, of course. There's adrenaline response that typically precedes the cortisol response. Epinephrine and norepinephrine systems are the ones that are responsible for that. But as a whole, what we're talking about in terms of the internal experience of stress physiologically is the what's known as the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis, which in effect is the thing that generates the cortisol and creates those sorts of things. Anxiety, in the book, I'm using that both colloquially as well as a kind of a symptomatology indicator. Typically, if we talk about anxiety clinically, we're talking about a higher level of this. It's a kind of a constant fearfulness, either in general, which we talk about as generalized anxiety disorder, or specific to certain situations. We often refer to those as phobias that really need to be dealt with clinically. So anxiety in that sense has a clinical definition in the diagnostic lingo in both everyday life and in the sorts of things we're talking about here, is that it's the internal feelings of not being able to cope with things, of feeling overwhelmed or agitated not in control of certain things that are going on. So there's obviously some overlap between the clinical notion of anxiety and our everyday notion of anxiety, but they all focus around the same thing of a perception of difficulties or threats or things that we're fearful of that we can't quite handle that we then need to react to in one way or another.
So why is the period from conception through the first year of life so crucial?
Well, primarily it's because that's the period during which the fundamental structure of that HPA axis is being set. So once it's set, the evidence is that it's pretty hard to change. Now, there are things that we can do to alter how that HPA axis functions, but its basic physiology of when it gets triggered, how long it stays activated, what is necessary to bring it down to a baseline state. The evidence that we have at this point suggests that that period from sort of during fetal life through the infancy period is pretty much sets how that system will react. Now, what will trigger it is something that we can later deal with or try to come to terms with or counteract the effects of that. Now, that period of time, we're talking here about, sort of human infants, obviously, but there's a very similar pattern, different age spans, but very similar pattern that we see in a number of different primate species that have been studied, monkeys most particularly, in rodents as well. So the timeline differs across species, but the basic structure that gets set quite early on is consistent across species.
And you talk about stress dysregulation and stress methylation. Can you explain to us what those two things are?
So stress methylation is the epigenetic process whereby in the specific gene that I focus on in the book, because it's had the most research on it, is the gene within the stress system that's part of what's known as a glucocorticoid feedback loop. Basically, what that means is it's part of the system where once you begin to have this response, the stress response, the HPA axis kicks in, there's a feedback loop that comes back up to the brain and the hypothalamus and says, okay, we're cool, stand down, everything's all right, you can shut it down. When that gene is methylated, it doesn't take that instruction very well. Either it doesn't shut down or it shuts down very slowly or shuts down only partially, so that what you have then is this ongoing influx of cortisol beyond what the immediate situation would seem to call for. So stress dysregulation essentially is the term that we use to describe that. The faster and more frequent activation of the stress response system, the maintaining of that stress response at a very high level, and the difficulty of bringing it back to a calm state or a baseline state.
Is there any way the body can kind of react to this and learn to deal with the stress? If it's like, if someone has this issue all their life, is there a biological level through which we deal with SDR?
There are several. So there's actually been a fair bit of research on how to counteract the effect of this. And for an individual, it has to start with coming to understand that this might describe you, right? So that you're highly reactive to situations. You tend to go overboard in your reactions to situations. You have difficulty calming down in a situation. So in a sense, becoming aware of it is a first step. One of the ways it's kind of the most straightforward, if you will, and doesn't require a huge amount of psychological effort, if you will. I mean, it takes willpower, but physical exercise is a great way to try to bring that stress under control. You know, we talk about it as the fight or flight response. Well, that's because it activates a lot of energy in your body to get things done. If you're exercising, if you're physically active on a regular basis, you're burning up a lot of that excess cortisol. You're using what it's supposed to be used for back in the day, right? In the evolutionary sense, you're using up the energy that it's providing you, and that helps to burn off cortisol. Another one that we're beginning to understand much better the biological basis of it, we've known for a long time in terms of at a psychological and social level that good social connections with other individuals, a good social support network, a few good close friends, family, romantic partner, that kind of thing, has a very beneficial effect on a lot of these systems. As humans, we have this extra advantage. We do have the potential for consciousness. We do have the potential for thinking clearly about the sorts of things that are going on. And one of the best stress reducers that we know of that draws on that system is what's known as mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR. And the mindfulness-based stress reduction does show some changes in the brain over time. The evidence for that is increasing. One of the things it does is allow us to stay in the present and to see situations more as they are without dipping too badly into the past in terms of regrets or recriminations or resentments and rumination on the one hand, and prevents us from worrying too much about unarticulated fears about the future or catastrophic fears about the future. That mindfulness-based stress reduction, it doesn't necessarily change how the HPA axis functions, but it can create a variety of circumstances in which we sufficiently create a habit whereby we don't kind of allow it to kick in. And then a final one I'll mention, which is kind of similar in some ways because it relies on our ability to do conscious planning and so forth, is the notion of control. When we most feel stress is when we have demands that are being placed on us or that we feel are being placed on us or threats that we are experiencing over which we believe we have no control and that we feel that we have no control. So active planning to try to understand those and deal with them as much as we can problem solve in the real world about them is one important thing. And that does in fact reduce HPA activity, as does beginning to execute some kind of a plan. Now, I should be clear that we can't control everything in our environment. If one's in a workplace situation where there's high toxic stress because the manager is, you know, has stress dysregulation and is constantly flying off the handle, you can't, unless you change jobs, you can't necessarily control that. But you can look for ways in which you can exercise control in a somewhat more limited way, or maybe you do plan to, in fact, move on to something else if the opportunity arises or seek such opportunities. So there are multiple ways that we can, in fact, deal with this system. It will be particularly helpful for individuals who are stress dysregulated, but may be particularly difficult for them to enact. Their social connections are hard to develop and maintain, for example, because of their tendency to either lash out or withdraw, which creates obvious difficulties for developing and maintaining social connections.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What does stress dysregulation look like at different phases of development? What does it look like in an infant?
Parents who have had newborns and have gone through that period of infancy will know that there's that infants are pretty volatile in their mood, right? I mean, they can get pretty upset pretty quickly. And part of our job as parents is to help them come down, to help regulate that sort of fussiness or upset or however it's getting expressed. And there are a bunch of things that we know that we can try, right? So we can figure out, oh gosh, we need to change their diaper? Are they hungry? Do they need to eat something? Do they need, you know, a cuddle and some moving around? And we know that touch is a great a soother and a great opportunity to do that. Those are the things, and infants, you know, do that a lot, and parents spend a lot of time doing that. The stress dysregulated infant, you can run through that whole gamut several times, and you still don't get the desired effect. That is, the baby is still being upset. They're still not settling down into a calm state. They're not getting their kind of either their physiology or their behavior regulated. And so, you know, you have the fussy face or the crying or the inability to settle down. You can see the same thing coming up at sleep time. They often will have difficulty falling asleep. If they're asleep, they get more easily awakened by any kind of change in their environment. And when that happens, it's much harder to get back to sleep. So for an infant, we understand they don't have much in the way of an internal system that helps them to regulate. We have to provide externally the things that create the soothing and the ability to regulate. But for a stress dysregulated infant, it's very hard, even with that external input, to help them get back to that calm state.
And what about kids and adolescents? I mean, obviously kids can express themselves, but what would a typical child with stress dysregulation look like or act like?
It typically takes one of two forms. One form would be, you know, and they roughly correspond to the fight or flight response. So one response is that the overreaction goes in the direction of lashing out at others, to this kind of unpredictable or random aggression or you know, hostile speech and that sort of thing, so that they're being like, you know, sort of, you never know what's going to set them off. From other kids' point of view, you never know what's going to trigger this kind of response. Or the opposite is to kind of flee, and flee in this case means into kind of a social withdrawal, that you feel so overwhelmed and difficult and so threatened and unable to do anything about it that you stop interacting with others. And that's a kind of a pattern that we'd see in kids and adolescents, and in fact carries over into adulthood. It gets particularly troublesome for adolescents, because a big part of adolescence is figuring out how to deal with the peer situation, the peer game. And we know that teens' brains get particularly activated in the presence of peers. That's one of the areas that are sort of primed to develop a kind of attention and real salience. And of course, these things that we've just been talking about get in the way of that. They make it very difficult to create those kinds of social connections. Other kids are not happy about being randomly aggressed on. And if you're just withdrawing and going away, kids are not necessarily going to go and seek you out to try to create some kind of a social connection. So that's the general pattern of what we'd see both in children and adolescents, that has particularly additional problematic consequences during the adolescent years.
What can parents do as some sort of intervention for this? I mean, people listening may recognize themselves in this, but they certainly may recognize some traits of stress dysregulation in their children.
It differs obviously a bit by developmental period. For infants, I write in the book a little about this notion that we talked about in our group about super nurturing, which essentially is sticking with that soothing routine even well beyond what most people can kind of deal with or tolerate, right? Because doing that process, you typically are expecting to get something back. I mean, not consciously, but when you are successful in getting the baby to soothe and calm down and maybe fall asleep in your arms, it's a very big rush of oxytocin for you too, and not just for them. And so if you're missing that, it's hard to, that is, if they're not soothing, not only are they not soothing, but you're not getting much in the way of a kind of a positive feedback from that whole situation. For infants, one of the important things, of course, is that we need to have, ideally, what we would have is additional caregivers rather than just it falling only on one caregiver, which in our society is typically still the mom. The spouse has to be able to step up and help out in those situations. Extended family need to step up. So a lot of that has to do with it's much harder to create for the newborn who has stress dysregulation to create a sense of trust, a sense of calm that things are taken care of. But it is even more essential that that happens. Now, for kids and adolescents, it, again, differs a little between them. For kids, trying to create circumstances in which they can make positive social connections is very important. And being aware of trying to provide a very structured environment for them, a very non-chaotic. Chaotic environments are the worst thing for stress dysregulated kids. Well, they're the worst situations for all kids, but it's particularly problematic for them. So creating routines, structures, boundaries, but also very much on the direction of being warm and responsive and contingent, again, building up the sense of trust that things can happen. Helping to, in a sense, smooth the way to develop social connections, trying to arrange, let's say, play dates for your kids with kids who appear to be more tolerant of whatever their particular issues are can be helpful. And at some level, helping them to become aware of you're feeling these reactions, but here are other ways, here are other options to behave. So if you look at the kinds of things that say kids who act out, who are the lashers out, we call externalizing, giving them some very simple things to prevent creating a big problem with their peers is very helpful. With the, there are a variety of programs out there, but a lot of the things they have in common is to, stop what you're doing. Don't actually physically lash out. Maybe hug yourself, which has the advantage of giving yourself touch, which helps. It prevents you from hitting out at somebody else if you're hugging yourself. Taking very deep breaths and counting to 10, right? These are all pretty standard things. But they help enormously because what that's doing is it's not just preventing your behavior from getting in the way of connecting with other kids. You're actually regulating your own internal physiology by doing that. We regulate our physiology in these ways, lots of different ways. Deep breathing has a huge impact on our stress response system, right? The deep breathing in meditation, for example, is not just a discipline. It is a discipline, a mental discipline, but it also helps our body just to calm down and to soothe itself. Now, adolescents, a lot of it would be the same kinds of things. For teens, you can't really do the making arrangements for their social connections with peers anymore. They have to navigate that on their own. But helping them to understand the ways in which their behavior may be getting in their own way and helping them at some point, because their level of conscious awareness, their level of, in the brain, the prefrontal cortex is developing during this period of time, they can become more aware of what their own responses are and how to help mitigate their responses and navigate that system better.
Is SDR, stress dysregulation itself, a clinical diagnosis? If I were to go to a psychologist and describe these symptoms, would they diagnose me with this, or would it be like a factor in other diagnoses?
It's not a clinical condition. And in fact, part of the point that I would be arguing about here is to say, this affects lots of people. You don't have to, to get to the level of a clinical diagnosis for, let's say, anxiety or for externalizing disorders of several different kinds that would be clinically diagnosable. There has to be quite a substantial level of impact on everyday life in a way that's really very impactful. And if you look up the definitions of those disorders, you'll see that in the DSM-5 where these definitions used or drawn from. What we're talking about here is more like kind of everyday stress, but to a very high level, right? So that in effect, what you've got is a situation that affects more individuals than would be clinically diagnosable. But nevertheless, over time has a negative impact on developmental outcomes, learning outcomes, behavioral outcomes, emotional outcomes, as well as over a long enough time, it has a negative effect so that we see these stress-related disorders and diseases emerging in adulthood. Having said that, stress dysregulation is also associated with many of those clinical diagnoses. We would, in fact, see for kids who have anxiety diagnoses or one of the several kinds of externalizing diagnoses, we would typically see stress dysregulation in them, but it's not only in them that we would see it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Let's say you make it into adulthood without having tended to the stress dysregulation. What does that look like? And what can adults do to help themselves? You know, I think that sometimes the first thing we think to do is to go to see a specialist and get some sort of diagnosis and get medication. What does stress regulation look like for adults?
Many of the symptoms are the sorts of things that we would expect. So the sort of the a hair trigger temper or an overreaction to small events that lead us to lash out at others and to become, you know, sort of distancing to others or to disrespect others and those sorts of things. Road rage you can think of as a kind of everyday example of these sorts of things or things that kind of lead us to have these overreactions to, you know, everyday situations that many of us would find, you know, that would make us ticked off or annoyed or whatever, but we don't kind of go off, fly off the handle, so to speak. So that would be one direction. Another direction is that we're fearful and unwilling to engage in social interactions, even when it's important or to our advantage to do that. And I want to make a distinction here because the other, in some ways, people might think, oh, well, that sounds like introversion, but it is not. Introversion, Susan Cain has written about in Quiet and in other places, and other folks have been taking up the cause. Introversion is a kind of a preference for having alone time and so forth, but it is not and needs not become impactful in the way that we withdraw from social situations, even ones that are important to us in terms of a variety of things. So this kind of you know, sort of the fight response being overreaction or the flight response in a social sense being an overreaction. Now, it is the case that adults can take action on their own behalf, or their friends and family, their loved ones can perhaps help guide them towards these sorts of things. There are things that one can do. I think one of the things is as a first step for any of these things, is this kind of awareness, the recognition that, hey, wait a second, not everybody behaves this way. Not everybody has these, you know, tremendous physiological responses to relatively what other people just kind of are able to just kind of wave off and say, yeah, well, that's just the way it is. But, you know, I'm not going to get myself, you know, in a twist because of it. You come to an awareness that, wait a second, you know, I'm having this these, you know, palpitations and heart racing and maybe breathing, you know, difficulties or whatever, because I'm getting so upset and agitated and overwhelmed and anxious with behaviors or circumstances that other people can deal with. So coming to an awareness that says, hey, this would be something that would be worth thinking about. I don't have to behave this way. I don't have to feel this way, right? And then the things that we mentioned before, one can try to pick up those things that will work. The exercise model is one that's very helpful. Making the most of social connections. And we know that social connections are a strong path to resilience, to overcoming early adversity, and that can happen into adulthood as well, that we develop a strong connection with one or more other people, and they help us to regulate ourselves so that we can, in fact, get to that point. The notion of a kind of a mindfulness-based stress reduction, none of these are easy necessarily, but they are highly effective in thinking about how we can do our best to take control of the situations that are most problematic for us, coming up with a plan to try to maximize what control we do have or change the context that we're in and begin to execute the plan. Beginning an execution of a plan is also important. So there are multiple ways, and they obviously, the more of them you do, the more odds you have of being able to bring this kind of a stress dysregulation under control. I think, you know, we don't have any way now that we know of to change that basic HPA axis function. You're probably stuck with that if you've got it activated into adulthood, but you can mitigate and work around it in lots of very effective ways.
So what about resilience? Can people kind of grow to be accustomed to these stress dysregulation levels? Is there an aspect of resilience?
So I think accustomed, you know, sort of there are two ways to become accustomed. One is that you just stay in that pattern and you say, oh, well, this is just how I am, right? Even if I come across as a jerk to other people, I'm okay with that, right? I don't mind that. That's not typically the response that people have because they feel pretty upset when these things are going on for them, and they're feeling upset way more of the time than they would like or than other people are experiencing. The other is a pathway to resilience. In a sense, the younger that you are, the more that pathway can be highly successful for overcoming early adversity. In infancy, this kind of super nurturing is a very potent path towards that. But certainly through childhood and adolescence, we know that particularly making one of the best things that we know about is making good, strong social connections. My friend and colleague Ann Mastin had a book a few years ago called Ordinary Magic in terms of what are the things that lead to resilience. And that's one of the best ones. In late adolescence and early adulthood, a romantic partner whom we can make a connection with who has the ability to create this kind of soothing function and move us toward not just soothing and calming us down, but helping us to find our more calm self inside is one of the best things that we know of for moving those things along. So resilience, I mean, the original meaning of the term, of course, is bouncing back. And it means that we've got this tough start, but that we find ways to overcome that. We find ways to, in fact, turn out to be successful in many of the areas of life that many of us would want to be successful in. And that we develop a pattern of behavior that allows us to cope with the inevitable challenges and threats and difficulties that everybody faces in life in a more, modulated, well-regulated, and problem-solving way.
What are some specific programs that exist that are aimed at combating this stress epidemic?
There are a number of them out there, and they differ, by age group. And in the book, at the end of each chapter, I have a fairly long list of resources that people could turn to. I think that one can, the mindfulness literature is growing very rapidly, and there are a lot of books out there that, mindfulness or mindfulness combined with meditation. I mentioned before the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn and his colleagues and others that have taken up that pattern of work on this. Those are some of the most useful ways because, in a sense, you can access them as an individual. You can try to make use of them as an individual. They're often fairly well laid out as a series of steps that you can take. So I would certainly, if one's going to try to undertake this oneself, I would say, that's definitely a different route, a valuable route. A different one would be the notion of how you can help to develop or try to develop these kinds of social connections, right? How can you go about doing that? There aren't so many, kind of self-help things around those kinds of areas. Sometimes working with a health professional, licensed psychologist or a psychiatrist or someone who deals with these things can be very helpful. And I should say that if one worries that one has a sufficiently elevated level of these reactions, that they might be a clinically diagnosable thing, that one should always consult a health professional. So if one has high enough anxiety that it really should be diagnosed as anxiety, there are a variety of approaches combining some of the behavioral things that I mentioned, along with potential pharmaceutical intervention that can be a big help. So if it's sufficiently impactful and that you're worried that it may be that's certainly a way to go. Counseling, of course, is even short of those sorts of clinical diagnoses can be very helpful as well.
And what about like cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavioral therapy? Are those specific types of treatment that aim at changing thought patterns and changing behavior? Would those be something for people to look into?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think much of the world in how psychologists, clinical psychologists approach this or counseling psychologists approach this and deal with these issues, the ones that you've mentioned, are definitely the directions to go in and are the ones that are most frequently employed these days. I mean, if it's a social problem, certainly family systems therapy is another approach that one can take in terms of trying to get a more successful and satisfying set of relationships in terms of family dynamics. So those things that you mentioned are very helpful. You don't have to be diagnosed to benefit from those. Those can be a variety of things that can be helpful to individuals. And I think what we see with a variety of those is that the pathway that they're using to try to be helpful is, in a sense, along this general dimension of getting control and understanding our situation, a higher level of awareness, and creating a kind of if not explicitly a mindful-based stress reduction, something very similar to that, where we're becoming aware of the dynamics that are driving us and trying to get a conscious control over those dynamics so that we're in a sense, taking the lead rather than being driven by those underlying dynamics.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
Oh, you're welcome.
And now it's time for the upgrade of the week. Every week, we like to share a little life hack that we've made in our own lives. Myself, this weekend, it was a very nice, warm spring day in New York. And I made the decision, because it was actually a little too warm, that I'd finally buy an AC unit for my apartment.
Oh my God, this is huge.
This is huge. I've always like tried to just endure the heat.
Oh, Andy.
I don't know why I take pride in that.
Yeah, but, weird city masochism.
Yeah, but I've decided that before it gets too warm again, I'm going to get the AC. I have to do it.
So you made the decision or you actually got it?
I didn't actually get it. I just made the decision.
That's the first step. I can recommend somebody if you need help with installation. I have a guy.
You have a guy?
Yeah.
You think I might try to do it myself? That might be foolish.
Oh, wow.
It seems
okay.
Dangerous, but yeah, I might do it myself.
Yeah, you don't need a guy. You are the guy.
I am the guy. Melissa, have you upgraded this week?
Yes. So one of the things that I've been doing, you know, I've spoken about this before, is, you know, I try to exercise in the mornings. And one of the things that I've started doing in order to give myself the best chance of actually completing my goal of exercising before work is to arrange the apartment the night before so that I have as little to do as possible in order to get my exercise studio up and running, which means like moving the coffee table and like getting everything out of the way, laying out the yoga mat, like queuing up the DVD player, because yes, I use a DVD, and laying out my clothes, basically like creating an environment in which I can sort of automatically just sort of step into my exercise self. So that has been very helpful for me. And I also actually have an update on my upgrade from last week, which
Oh, yeah?
I talked about how I was very excited to have acquired a real carry-on bag that I thought was going to transform my life. And I had said that I got the Bagu carry-on with the zipper on top. I'm sad to report that the bag is gigantic and way too big to put under the seat in front of me. So for everybody who was waiting on tenterhooks, wondering if that bag was going to be amazing, it is not an amazing bag for me, but I have a couple other things that I'm considering, and I will update you as as the saga continues. And that's our show. You can find me on Twitter at Melissa Kirsch. You can find Andy at Andy Orin. The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
Do you have a suggestion for future episodes of The Upgrade? Shoot us an email at upgrade@lifehacker.com, tweet us at lifehacker with the hashtag TheUpgrade, or go old school and leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109. And if you love The Upgrade, go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. You can also find us on Panoply, NPR One, and wherever else you get your podcasts.
Follow Lifehacker on Twitter at Lifehacker and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.